So I'm going to launch in. Vajradarshini asked me if I would say something about beauty in the spiritual life. So I'm launching in, not knowing what you've been doing in the Monday nights before I came and what you're going to do afterwards. So anyway, I'm sure you could, there'll be a few things here that might be helpful for you. And I thought to myself, yeah, beauty in the spiritual life, there's so many aspects that one could talk about. There's so many ways of approaching that subject. But when Vajradarshini said it to me, I immediately thought about beauty as a quality in our spiritual life, a quality in our spiritual practice. And when I say that word quality, I'm talking about the quality of our connection and our response to life. And then I began to think about words like open, expansive, tender, touched, moved, shaken up, freedom. And I thought, for me, beauty is about truth, yeah, with a capital T, if you like. It's about the heart and it's about the mind. It's about waking up from a sleep, about being alive, fully alive. And it's about being connected to a wise mind and a kind heart. And I thought, well, you could change that round and you could also say a kind mind and a wise heart. So beauty is about looking at a quality of connection, a quality of how we relate to things, how we relate to all the circumstances of our life. And as you all know, life has its joys and its sufferings. So this is samsara. So it's not just relating to the joys in our life, but how we relate to the suffering in our life. I think this is about beauty. So I'm going to talk just about two aspects of beauty, which actually I work with, very much part of my spiritual practice. So I'm going to just share with you my reflections and associations. So one of the areas is linked to a word that many of you will have heard, and that's kalyana, or kalyana. So kalyana in Buddhism means ethically upright, virtuous. It's about the truth, what is true. It's about goodness and it's about beauty. And many of you know the words kalyanamitrata, spiritual friendship. And it's always a good reminder that the Buddha was talking to Ananda. And again, I'm sure you've all heard this. It gets quoted so many times. You know, Ananda was reflecting and he said to the Buddha, I think I find... the penny's dropped. The penny's dropped, Buddha. The spiritual life is half... the friendship is half of the spiritual life, isn't it? And the Buddha said, no, Ananda, it's the whole of the spiritual life. Yeah. And that is particularly important in Triratna, particularly important in our Sangha, in our spiritual community, in the order. So friendship is the whole of the spiritual life. And that is summed up, really, in kalyanamitrata, spiritual friendship. Friendship with the lovely, friendship with the upright, with truth and with goodness. So Bhante said something which is a quote I often use, particularly when I'm doing Kalyana Mitra ceremonies. So when Mitras who've asked for ordination decide to have two order members to accompany them as they enter the order, their Kalyana Mitras, there's a quote I always use, and that is, seeing the beauty in each other is the heart's way to wisdom. So seeing the beauty in each other is the heart's way to wisdom. I love this quote. So the question is, what stops us seeing the beauty in each other? And what is that wisdom in my heart? What is it that wisdom sees? What does it know? What does it respond to? And you know, this is a huge challenge, seeing the beauty in each other. It's a huge challenge. Because what stops us from doing that is our views, yeah? The views that we have. The views about how others should be. Seeing others on our own terms, under our conditions. And also thinking that they should respond to us in a particular way. So there's lots of views of what's right and what's wrong and what's good and what's bad. Even views of what it is to be a good Buddhist or a bad Buddhist. Yeah? So our whole life is spent, in a way, just acting out from our views, from our emotional anchors. And yes, we can feel hurt, we can feel angry, we can feel resentful, we can even feel insulted. But what exactly is in us which is hurt? What exactly in us is angry, is or feels insulted? And when we look at what it is, then usually it comes down to the views of who I am, how my world is, how my world should be, how others should treat me. So, no prizes for guessing what we're talking about here. E-G-O. Ego. So ego is a word that we use an awful lot. And basically the ego is the views and the thoughts and feelings that we have which circle around me, circle around myself. So I, me, mine. And we hold on to our interpretations of our experience. And we hold on to them because they give us security. They give us ground under our feet. They give us a way of relating to the world. It's a sense of knowing, in inverted commas, yeah? Or thinking that we know. And that sense of ego, as all of us will experience, is sometimes tight and narrow and like a knot, and sometimes we experience it as looser, more pliable, more flexible. So here I want to talk a little bit about beauty as vulnerability. Vulnerability, and another word for that would be defenselessness. So showing ourselves nakedly as we are. And when vulnerability meets vulnerability, there is automatically compassion and wisdom. I have nothing to defend. I am simply who I am, meeting another being who is simply who they are. Don't have to do anything. Compassion and wisdom is there. And this is something we can practice in the Sangha. It's much, much harder to do this outside the Sangha. Much harder. But in the Sangha, this is what we need to be practicing more and more. Vulnerability, defenselessness. And for that, we need trust and we need friendship. It's not going to happen straight away. We need conditions of trust and conditions of friendship. And it needs courage, it needs spiritual courage. So vulnerability is about not hiding myself. Defenselessness is not defending myself. So getting rid of the masks, getting rid of the armour, getting rid of the weapons and the defences that we have. And I think that it's perfectly natural and perfectly human to feel threatened and to feel insecure. And in a way, it's just part of our existential dilemma. Because we do feel threatened, we do feel insecure. It's a part of being a human being. But it's also understanding that dilemma, understanding samsara, which is, in fact, exactly that dilemma. And I notice these days, it's more easy for me, I would say that, yeah. It's more easy for me to put my trust in what I don't know or where I am insecure than to put my trust in something I think I know and something I think is secure. Because it's not. And I notice when people talk to me and they tell me, oh, I'm going to do this Kulanandi, and then I'm going to do that, and then I'm going to do that, and then I'm going to do that, and then I'm going to do that. And I go, I don't know that I can put my trust in that. But if somebody says, oh, I don't know what I'm going to do. I really don't know what I'm going to do. I've got this, and I've got this. And I've got that. And I'm just going to hold it all and watch what happens. Just watch what happens. That I can put my trust in. So, yeah, I notice these days I'm not really that interested in finding solutions or answers or anything which might have a fixed nature, a fixed quality. So I'm more interested in connecting and relating to what's there in all its colourfulness. In all its contradictions, in all its paradoxes. So connecting and relating to the here and now. And, yeah, opening up to what is true, how things really are. And I think, I experience that very much as at odds with society. At odds with the demands of society. Society wants answers. Society wants the rational mind. It wants materialism. But using this phrase, it is as it is. It is as it is. I don't need to add anything. I don't need to take anything away. And leaving things or letting things be as they are allows things to be. Allows them to be. And this is freedom. And I was thinking, well, what do I mean by that? It's freedom. And I thought about the six element practice, which some of you might have done, where you look at the elements. So the sixth element is mind. So you look at earth. Earth, water, fire, air and ether, atmosphere, and then our minds. I hope that's six. And as our beings, our body, our physical body and our consciousness is made up of these six elements. That's all our bodies are, these six elements. And these six elements are exactly what makes up the world, what makes up our universe. So you do this exercise, you do this practice as a practice against pride, against conceit, against thinking you're special. And just allowing the elements to come and to go, to come in the body, to leave the body, to come into the universe and leave the universe, is in a way letting the elements go back, or not go back, but letting the elements just be free, just letting the elements be themselves, not grasping onto them as I, me or mine. And I love this practice, and I love the aspect of just letting things be as they are, giving things back their freedom in a way, not grasping. And last autumn, I was on a retreat in Rivendell in England with an order member called Atala. I don't know if anybody's ever heard his name. Some of you. He's a very, very long-standing order member. I don't know how many years he's been ordained. Maybe about 40. He's a very long-standing order member. And he's very much into myth and very much into stories and myth. And when you talk to him, you really feel that you're met in a way that he gives you back to yourself. Yeah? He doesn't take anything from you. He doesn't add anything onto you. You feel he's just giving you back to yourself. And this is a very, for me, a very special phrase, a very special idea or concept to give other people back to themselves, or to give the elements back to themselves. For me, this is freedom. Because usually what we do in our relationships with ourselves or with others or with the world is we look for our opportunity. We look for our advantage, where we can advance our own interests, where we can promote our own interests, or promote ourselves, or promote our views. And sometimes we think we have a right to do this. We justify our rights. We justify ourselves, justifies what we should have. Or if somebody else does something we don't like, we feel we have a right to tell them what they're doing is not good. And yes, things come our way very often which are unethical, which are unskillful. But what's my motive in telling another person that their actions are unskillful or unethical? Is it about me promoting my views of how the world should be and, in a way, installing my own security? Or am I really interested in their well-being and the fact that their unethical behaviour or unskillful behaviour will lead to their suffering? So where am I coming from? So yes, Buddhist ethics is about intentions, about our motives for acting with body, speech and mind. And for me, beauty is also about ethics. I reckon you could probably give a whole talk in itself about ethics as beauty, yeah? Ethics as beauty, truth and goodness. There's a lot in that. But I think for me, ethics is about loosening up that self, loosening up the ego, loosening up our advantages, looking for our advantages, getting things our own way, under our terms and conditions. And it loosens up that indifference we have to our effect on others and other living beings. So I'm not just talking about humans, I'm also talking about animals, insects. So I think we try to seize happiness and avoid suffering. And ethics is about taking responsibility for that, seeing the effect of our actions. And in that word responsibility, in English, is the word response. So ethics is about our response to life. And to what extent wisdom and compassion figures in this response. So what we're talking about here is karma niyama. Some of you might have heard about these five niyamas. So the five niyamas are, you could say, sets of conditionality which have an effect on us. And karma niyama is the set of conditions which is where actions have consequences. So the karma niyama is, for most of us, our main practice ground in spiritual practice, in the practice of the Dharma. Just becoming more and more aware of our ethical responses to life. And there is a beauty in moving away from self-centeredness. Moving away from selfing, from seizing and pushing away, from wanting and not wanting. And we realise that practising ethics is more than being sort of nice and friendly and doing the right things. It's much more than that. It's much more than promoting myself and looking for an advantage. practicing ethics softens and loosens. Softens the ego, it loosens the ego. And bit by bit, we lift up our heads and we begin to see there's a bigger perspective and there's more possibilities. And I think, well, for me, certainly, when I began to lift up my head, I also allowed a yearning in me, if you like, a wanting, a skillful thirsting, a skillful hunger in me to want to move beyond myself. I didn't want this tightness of the ego, the tightness of selfing. And I think I began to also see that I had values, that I held values in my heart. I held things which were very important to me, that had significance and that had meaning, and that I wanted a bigger context to express these. And I think this was, and I think for all of us, this is our response to beauty. But I think it's our response to beauty on a transcendental level. So it's moving beyond ourselves, moving beyond what we now know. And I don't know how you relate to the transcendental level. Maybe it's just a word for you. But I'm pretty sure that it's tied up for you with something which is bigger and greater and more beautiful than what you now experience. And perhaps it's tied up with the Buddha, or perhaps it's tied up with a particular bodhisattva, or perhaps it's tied up with the blue sky. But it's something where we can lose, literally lose, ourselves, yeah? Where we can lose, or each one of us can lose ourself. So it's a response to something that goes over, goes beyond, way beyond us, our tight, narrow self. And it's something that's magical, it's something that's mysterious. So what we're talking about here is the Dharma Niyama. So the Karma Niyama, practicing ethics, is a doorway into the Dharma Niyama. And the Dharma Niyama are those conditions which have a transcendental nature. So you could say ethics is a stepping stone to, in a way, opening up to a bigger perspective, opening up to a bigger dimension. Letting go of self, loosening and softening self. So in a way, both the Karma Niyama and the Dharma Niyama gives us a sense of our understanding being stretched. And the quality of our response to life being stretched. Truth is stretching us. Stretching us beyond ourselves. So the next thing I want to go on to, and in a way it's not that it's not linked, it is linked, but it's turning towards our own suffering. And I realise this is quite a big number in a way, quite a big number for us. And it's something I experience as a quality of our Sangha connections, a quality of the spiritual life. I think that's the biggest quality that the Sangha offers. It offers us the chance to turn towards our suffering, to turn towards dukkha, and not to avoid it, not to run away from it, not to pretend it's not there, not to think there's something wrong with us, because we suffer. Sangha puts it in context for us. And the way that we respond to each other when we're suffering gives us a context to understand our suffering more deeply. I think this is one of the best things about Sangha, the best thing about the spiritual community. It really encourages us to turn towards our suffering. And the rest, you know, most people in society just don't want to turn towards their suffering. Yeah. They don't want this. And so it's a real gift that the Sangha offers. So life is samsara, like I said. It's suffering and it's joy. But Buddhism doesn't judge. It doesn't say suffering is better than joy and joy is better than suffering. It just doesn't judge. It says this is samsara. And our response to both is with wisdom and compassion. So I don't think we can really understand samsara or open up to suffering or develop a sensibility towards suffering. Let's say if we can't do this, if we can't understand suffering, if we close off to suffering, if we pretend it's not there and avoid it and try to trick it, it's very difficult to really practice ethics. And I know, I can remember being in a study group, in a Mitra study group actually, where one Mitra tried to convince me that if you really put your mind to it and you practice carefully, you can avoid dukkha. Yeah. So a huge, huge wrong view. Yeah. So if you just manage to get it right in life, you can avoid dukkha. Yeah. You can't. Yeah. It's a completely wrong view. You cannot avoid dukkha. It's part of life. And I think if you're trying to trick yourself out of dukkha, you can't practice ethics. And you certainly can't practice the 8th, 9th and 10th precepts, which the order, when you become an order member, you take on 10 precepts. And the 8th, 9th and 10th precepts are about wisdom and compassion. So the 8th precept is you transform greed. The 9th precept is you transform hatred. And the 10th precept is you transform delusion. So those three last precepts are about insight into the nature of samsara, insight into the nature of conditionality. So unless you really understand suffering and you understand samsara, it's very hard to practice the precepts. And when you're ordained, in a way you take, they're called precepts, but actually they're vows to really transform greed, hatred and delusion in your life. Those three emotions at the centre of the wheel of life, at the hub of the wheel of life. So you're taking on board a huge reorientation of your being, of your whole being. So I think samsara, with its suffering and its joy, can be very confusing. I think it is very confusing. And I think it's important to embrace this confusion, just to let it be there, let it work on us. I think it's important to embrace paradoxes and contradictions and the conflicts and the tensions in us. And really understanding that samsara will throw these up. It will throw these up quite naturally. And getting to know these paradoxes, these confusions, and just allowing them to be there. And I think if we fight or if we struggle against them, it's like putting the second arrow. Yeah, it's hard enough dealing with samsara. But if we fight and struggle with samsara, it's just like having the second arrow in our eye. And often we're very surprised at samsara. Well, why is this happening to me? Why me? Yeah. We think we're somehow way outside of samsara. Yeah. And what I said, you know, this linear thinking. If I just do it right, I won't suffer. If I just find the right solution, everything will be okay. Getting it right and not getting it wrong, yeah? This polarization that we have. And a friend of mine once said that life is this moment-to-moment experience of either life building up or life falling apart. Yeah, that's how we normally experience it. from moment to moment. Either, oh, things are going really well, or, oh, God, what's happening? Yeah. And, yeah, we can ask ourselves, how often do we experience that in 24 hours? So spiritual life is about holding tensions. It's about holding all of that. And, you know, what stops us holding the tensions is that often we have lots of ideals and expectations of where we should be and where we should be getting to and how we should be. And this stops us actually just holding it, just waiting with it. And, you know, all of us are familiar, I think, with Bhante's, well, it wasn't a quote, was it? But it's sort of one of Bhante's aphorisms that in terms of the Bodhisattva ideal, there's this constant tension between the needs of ourselves and the needs of others. We know this tension. Yeah, we read this all the time in Bhante's work. And we studied it in Mitra study. We studied it on Buddhist courses. But actually, that's just one tension. Yeah, there are many, many tensions in the spiritual life. So we can ask ourselves, are you able to set up and work with these tensions in your spiritual life? Can you hold tensions? Can you identify tensions? Can you relate to the different aspects of yourselves involved in these tensions? They'll be contradictory, they'll be conflicting. They won't always be comfortable to hold. Certainly, many of them not comfortable to hold. Can you enter into relationship with each of these tensions? Can you connect with them? Can you respond to them? Can you allow what's there to be there? It's not easy. It's really not easy. And sometimes we can manage it and then we lose it completely. We really lose the plot and then we have to start again. So there has to be a willingness to wait and there has to be courage and faith. And when we pick up the threads of our life, are we holding them tightly? Or are we holding them too tightly, or are we holding them too lightly, too loosely? So I think there's, how do we hold these tensions? Is it too tight? Is it too loose? And there's holding, this is a little mantra we had on our weekend. We had a weekend here for women mitras. And the mantra was holding, waiting, relaxing. Holding, waiting, relaxing. And this is very much at odds to what our ego wants. Our ego demands solutions. It demands action, answers, immediate gratification, yeah? Immediate signals that we're okay and that we're doing all right. Justifications of what we're doing. Our ego is hungry for security. We need to know that. And that means we need faith in conditionality, faith in conditions, conditions arising, conditions falling away. And if we can hold tensions and keep them, communicating with each other, responding to each other, connecting with each other, then something unfolds, which is far, in a way, far more creative than just looking for an answer to that and an answer to that. Letting them just work with one another. Something unfolds, which is of a very different nature, of a very creative nature. And recently, I was talking with a friend about focusing on things in our lives. And often that focusing in our lives is about focusing on things we want and things we don't want. And we hold very tightly. So this focusing is really, it's like sort of this narrowing down onto something. And it's usually what we want and what we don't want. And we hold it very tightly. And any sort of focusing whether it's joy or suffering, it doesn't really matter, has a very narrow nature to it. It's narrow. And what widens that out and what makes that whole thing in a way more real and in a way more tender is allowing our vulnerability into the focusing. So when we're wanting and not wanting, and this strong holding, it's just allowing vulnerability, or if you like, allowing dukkha into the nature of it, into the mix. And when we were talking about this and discussing it, I could feel it happening. It was like the whole thing widens out. Dukkha is a truth, yeah? Vulnerability is a truth. So allowing our vulnerability into a mix, not focusing down narrowly onto what we want and don't want, allows something to widen up, allows truth to reveal itself, allows a softer approach, a bigger picture, allows our humanness to be there. It's interesting because recently I've had lots and lots of talks about dukkha and vulnerability. Yeah, it's been very, very, very constructive actually. I remember some years ago, I kept saying, you know, it's a sort of, you know how you get these mantras. And one of my mantras was, all communication is confession. And I thought, what am I talking about? And all communication is confession. Well, I was completely convinced about this. And I don't think I meant confession of faults as we normally use that. Not that necessarily, but it was something more. I was trying to get at a quality of communication. And I think what I was trying to get at was an honesty which is transparent and in a way showing a vulnerability, showing this vulnerability. So communicating or communication which has a quality of being constantly vulnerable, constantly honest and transparent. And I'm sure all of you have experience being with people, and I hopefully people within the Sangha, but maybe not, because I think some people do have this quality outside the Sangha, of being with somebody who is just themselves, just who they are. They're not hiding anything. They're not adding anything to who they are. They're just themselves in their vulnerability. It's very refreshing. It's very refreshing to be with a person like that. And you feel they're sharing their experience of themselves, their struggles, their victories, their joys, their sadness. They're not holding back and they're not promoting themselves. They're not presenting themselves. They're not telling you a story. They're just being themselves. And when we're with people like that, it really is uplifting. It really is beautiful. Yeah, it's in a way, I feel, it's a bit like being with silk. Yeah, it's a bit like being with silk. And I think when I'm with people and they're like that, there's a quality of connection which they have with themselves and with their own experience. And it also allows me to have a quality of connection with myself when I'm listening to them. And I feel like they're talking in a way where they're giving themselves back to themselves. And actually what happens is I feel I'm given back to myself in that communication. I mean, I don't know whether you know what I'm talking about, but something very special happens. So I think that quality of communication, that quality of just coming from your vulnerability unashamedly and with courage and with warmth and with confidence comes from an ability of having reflected over your own experience or reflection about your own experience, self-reflection. That quality of communication comes from a kind heart, a heart which is kind towards yourself, towards others, towards the world. And it comes from a wise mind. So an understanding of nature, an understanding of the nature of samsara, an understanding your own nature. And when it comes into our experience, when we're with someone who's like that, it's a real gift. I experience it as a gift. It's almost like learning how to be a human being. And that made me think, when I was writing this, that made me think that there are many people who contribute to the quality of my life by just being who they are. And I think that, I know I've said that here before in a talk, but when I started to get in, I've been interested in nonviolent communication for about 10 years and practicing. And it was a real eye-opener to me because I think I realised that I have a strong tendency to look at what's problematic and what's wrong with other people, with myself, other people and the world, yeah? And nonviolent communication taught me to balance that up with looking for actually what's of quality that's being given to me from others or from my environment. And yeah, these are gifts. When people give something to us that brings a quality into my life. And I'm sure you've heard this story. This is because I often tell this story. But it was a time when a penny really dropped. And it was on an MVC course in England. I was there for a week with the same group. And we met every day. And there was one man... some of you will remember this story. There was one man in this group that really was a pain in the neck. Yeah, I really didn't like this man. Do you understand pain in the neck? Do you understand the English? Okay. I thought he was a pain in the neck. Everybody else seemed to get on with him apart from me. Anyway, he really got on my nerves. And I just felt, oh, he's got such a big ego. And you know how those thoughts go on. And I tried to avoid him, but it was difficult because we were a small group and we were often working in small groups or pairs. So I ended up working with him and I was a bit wary and a bit resentful at having to work with this man. Anyway, I don't know, it must have been the fourth day, third or fourth day out of 5 days. And obviously something had opened up inside me, you know, working with these people. And working with our thoughts and feelings. And he said, I was just standing opposite him, ready to start working on something. And he said something which was really funny. It was really funny. And I laughed. And in that moment, I mean, it sounds a small thing. It was a small thing. But in that moment, I thought, this man has given me something. He's just given me something. And it's made my life brighter. And I've laughed. And it was funny what he said. And it was a small thing, but a penny dropped. And I'll never forget that. Because he made me laugh. And he brightened my world, maybe for a few seconds. And he gave me something. And we're giving each other those things all the time. Yeah, we're giving each other gifts all the time. But this was a learning, a very, very... a lovely, very tender, warm learning in my life. So I think gratitude, those gifts that come our way from other people, whether it's a joke, whether it's just a warmth of response, whether it's a generosity of action, I think gratitude, experiencing gratitude, is also responding to beauty. It's responding to the beauty in others. And I think gratitude is also giving attention to detail. Like, in a way, just noticing, laughing at that joke that the man told me and really seeing, oh, yeah, he's given me something. It was a small thing. So gratitude about giving attention to detail. beauty is there. And do we see it? Do we see it? Do we really appreciate what others give to us? And I think what stops us appreciating what others give us is that often we're just preoccupied with our own interests. We're overly focused. I think we're very impatient. You know, we want to move forward, we want to get on. You're getting in my way, you're taking up my time, you know. Which, of course, you know, that's also an ethical thing, yeah. I haven't got time to talk to you. I haven't got time to look at you. I haven't got time to deal with your question. It's all about greed, in a way. I'm more important in this moment. So I think that's what often stops us seeing what's really there. And I think very often we have quite a blunt heart and a blunt mind, a dull heart or a dull mind. And a friend of mine used to talk about having a lazy heart. I like that. A lazy heart and a lazy mind. So not really seeing what's coming towards us. Not enough space inside us to really see beauty, to really appreciate what's coming from others, how they're bringing qualities into our lives. So one thing I was thinking about in terms of attention to detail, giving detail attention, I don't know whether you've ever done this, I'm sure you have. You know, sometimes you can have a real aversion towards a particular insect. Yeah, whatever it is, spiders or wasps or bees or something. I don't know if you've ever done the practice of really looking at the insect. Yeah, really looking at it. And looking at the detail in the body and the colour and the movements. But I've done that. I do that on solitaries very often because there are particular insects that I'm quite frightened of. And I really try to make it a practice of looking. Attention to detail. And what happens is I notice that my fear dissipates. It goes away. My aversion goes away. Because actually I'm afraid of what I don't know. I've got an idea of this insect, but I don't really know the insect. I've just got this idea in my mind. And I'm afraid of this insect harming me in some way. So I notice my fear is what I don't know, what's unfamiliar, what's different to me. And I don't see the beauty in that case. I don't see the beauty of this insect. I don't see its colour. I don't see its movements. You know, it's just, in a way, something I don't want in my life. And I think this practice of attention to detail really opens up our appreciation of things. And I'm sure if you haven't done insects as a practice, you've definitely done things like looking at flowers or looking at a blade of grass or looking at a leaf or looking at a stone and just looking at it in detail and discovering a whole world in that, a whole world of beauty in that. So this is, in a way, you know, we could imagine just looking at each other in that same way, discovering a world of beauty in each other. So I think beauty is about saying yes to life and all its forms. Life within me and life outside of me. Why make a difference? It's just beauty. Saying yes to beauty is also saying yes to freedom. And how do I develop the eyes of freedom? How do I give things back to themselves? Allow things to be what they are. Allow others to be as they are. Well, I think I need a heart and a mind that feels at home in the blue sky. A heart and mind that feels at home, soaring in the blue sky. And then how can I give life back to itself? Well, I think it's just summed up in that quote of Bantis, and this is what I'm going to end with. I can give life back to itself in the ability to see the beauty in each other, because that's the heart's way to wisdom. So that's it.